I'm going to read this, then we're going to do a two-minute meditation, and then we're going to do the prayer. So this one's called B. B-E. Spirit is within us. Spirit surrounds us. Part of it may be sensed. And is called manifestation. Part of it is unseen and is called void. To be with spirit is harmony. To separate from spirit is disaster. To act with spirit, observe and follow. To know spirit, be still and look within. Spirit is within us. We are spirit. It is also outside of us. It is in all the known universe. All that we can know of ourselves and of our universe cannot account for all that is spirit. What we know is merely the outer manifestation of spirit. The ultimate spirit is absolute. We cannot know it directly because it has no definitions, references, or names. Our normal minds are incapable of perceiving where there is no contrast. Yet it is precisely this colorless infinity that is the underlying reality to this life. The only way to fathom it is to remove our sense of division from it. In essence, we must plunge into the mystery itself. Only then will we know peace. Meditation. Prayer.
God, please lay aside everything I think I know about this weekend, the big book, alcoholism, addiction, the 12 steps, myself, and especially you, God, so I can have an open mind and a new experience. Help me to see the truth. Amen.
Amen. So, would you guys say that the mountains are part of the earth? How about the trees? How about the people walking around on it? How about the ocean? How about the fish inside of it? Okay. Well, there are a lot of people that don't think that we are actually part of the earth. But let's say we went to outer space and we looked back down at the earth. Would we then be part of the earth? If you were referring to earth, would we be part of it? If not, where else would we be? How about when we die? Do we become part of the earth, or are we still separate from? And I give this example often when we get into the second step, because what what it tells me, what it shows me, is that everything is really one. Okay? And if I'm going to try to define whatever this thing is, power, God, whatever, by one word, how could that possibly encapsulate all that is? And that's what that little reading before the meditation was about, is that everything that you think is spirit is, everything that you think is not spirit also is spirit. There's nothing separate. So, one of the myths, we didn't cover it on the first day, but one of the myths that I hear a lot is that a person says that I showed up at a meeting, therefore I've worked the first step. I've admitted I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable, therefore I've worked the first step. Maybe so, but Tarek and I have spent all the time that we've spent with you to this point just covering the first half of the first step. So how is it possible to just say, because I hear guys say it all the time, they come out of a treatment program or whatever, I've already worked the first three steps. Okay, well, what'd you do to work step one? Well, I mean, I'm clearly powerless. Well, why did the authors of the big books use so many pages to cover that? So There's that second part of the first step that we're just now getting into, which is the unmanageability. This is where, if you didn't think you were screwed before, we'll get you there here. Okay, this is the part that shows me that drinking and or using was not my real problem. My real problem is that I have no capacity to interact in this existence without something, in my case, alcohol, numbing that existence. I'm incapable. We are powerless over alcohol, dash, that our lives had become unmanageable. Unmanageability. Second half of the first step.
Page 44. In the preceding chapters and these 2 days this weekend, you learned something of alcoholism and addiction. We hope we've made a clear distinction between the alcoholic and non-alcoholic and the addict and the non-addict. Here you go. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, obsession, or if when drinking or using you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic or addict. If that's the case, here's the question. Do you believe you're suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer? To one who feels he is an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as we are means disaster, especially if you're an alcoholic or addict of the hopeless variety, someone who's wanted to stop and quit for a long time but can't. To be doomed an alcoholic death or addict death, or to live life on a spiritual basis, are not always easy alternatives to look at. Die the crackhead death, or live life on a spiritual basis. For me, it's a choice that comes from a place of no choice. I want to live, I want to breathe, there's no choice. Spiritual basis of life. Now, there's this wonderful thing we work with called Step Zero. Step Zero is that wonderfully horrific time between your last drink or your last drug and the point at which you give yourself to this program. So what that looks like in Step Zero is die the alcoholic death, or addict death, live life on a spiritual basis, or just don't drink no matter what, or just go to meetings, or just do my IOP, or just do my therapy, or wait till my parents cut me off. I don't care what you insert. There's always 3, 4, 5, there's other options.
Maybe you just need some good pot.
So, we need a life, we need a power in our lives that we can live by. So when you go to the, it goes down, go to the bottom paragraph on page 44. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life, like keep going, then meeting makers make it. If your ass hints of falling off, take it to a meeting. We don't drink no matter what. Work it. Keep coming back. What's that one?
Work it because you're worth it.
Yeah.
It works if you work it because you're
worth it.
Because you're worth it. I'm just not good at these slogans. They've never entered into my. So I struggle.
With all that being said, they are a code of morals and better philosophies of life.
The Serenity Prayer. That's a code of moral or philosophy of life.
If they're sufficient to overcome addiction and alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us no matter what, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. We could wish to practice the one-word principles behind each step. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power is not there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, are not sufficient. They fail utterly. When I gathered all my resources the best I could, I failed. So lack of power was my dilemma, and I had to find a power by which I could live. Wait, hold on. I had to find a power by which I could stop using drugs. No, I had to find a power by which I could live, and it had to be a power greater than myself, obviously. But where and how am I to find this power? And that's what the rest of this book is about. So they're not talking about just not drinking and just not using. They're talking about a living problem. Like, I am ill-equipped to exist in this creation we call the world. And so let's turn to page 52. Unmanageability. And Brandon's going to share a personal unmanageability exercise. I'm going to take you through the bedevilments real quick. And so what the big book asks, and this is an example of sober, untreated alcoholism and untreated addiction. This has nothing to do with alcohol and drugs unless you're still using or still drinking. So you have to ask yourself, I'm going to ask myself, why shouldn't I apply to my human problems, my life problems, the same willingness to change my point of view like I did with drugs and alcohol? So I ask myself, in what areas of my life am I having trouble in personal relationships? In what areas of my life am I unable to control my emotional natures? In what area of my life am I hunted by misery and depression? In what areas of my life do I find it difficult to make a living, right? I'm unhappy doing what I'm doing. I hate going to work every day. I hate doing this in this area of my life. In what areas of my life do I feel useless? In what areas of my life do I experience fear? Am I unhappy? Do I feel like I can't be of real help to other people? Was a basic solution to these problems from lack of power, the bedevilments, more important than whether I should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course, when I see others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon God, Spirit of the Universe, Creative Intelligence, Mother Nature, the Force, I have to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea does. Do I believe that? That's how you look at unmanageability. When you show up here and you're coming fresh off a run, unmanageability is closely related to the drug use. You're looking at charges. You're getting put on probation. You gave the dope man your car. You stole from your parents. You robbed people blind. I get it. But guys, the longer you stay away from a drink or drug, the real problem of alcoholism and addiction comes to the surface. I called it out earlier. Uneasy, easily annoyed by people and the world, and this feeling that you're never going to be satisfied. Restless, irritable, and discontent. That is the breeding ground for the mental obsession to return. That is the core problem. That is what the 12 steps will treat. Is that internal condition. But even if you apply the 12 steps, there's going to come a point in your recovery where this description fits. The dark night will descend on every single individual in this room. And when the dark night descends on a soul, only when all other things have failed. So nothing in your life seems to be working. When you're no longer a good meditator in the class, because meditation produces absolutely nothing for you. When prayer evaporates on your tongue and you have nothing left to say to God. When you're not even tempted to return to a life of worldly pleasure because the world has proven empty, all the relationships in your life have proven empty, and you have no sense of purpose. And yet taking another step through the void of the spiritual life feels futile because you are no good at it, and it seems as if your God has given up on you. You can scarcely conjure up your old passion for seeking God. It has become clear that you're unable to do anything on your own to remedy your spiritual brokenness. One of two things are going to happen. You will run for the hills and you will seek comfort in a thing that you will not get comfort from, which is drugs and alcohol, because your mind will become delusional and you will have no other options because the spring in your chest will be so tight. Or you're going to be moved into a deeper, more sincere prayer life with your God. And you're just going to weather the storm. And you're going to keep doing the work regardless of whether or not that experience plays out in your life. Now, that experience has played out in my recovery on two separate occasions in my recovery. And it was, the two deepest depressions. I experienced, there ain't a month go by that, not 1 month goes by that I don't experience some type of depression. I called Brandon a couple weeks ago, and I said, hey, I think a depression's moving through my life. It's okay. Depression is part of existence. We live in a culture that wants to give you a pill if you hint at being depressed. There's nothing wrong with being depressed from time to time. It's part of life. We don't live in that culture. I wonder if the depression shows up if I recalibrate and give more time to meditation, give more time to prayer, maybe pull out that 8-step list if I got some unfinished amends and go make some amends and begin to spend some more time with the guys I'm trying to sponsor. I wonder what would happen. But what do? We sit in solitary self-appraisal. We don't reach out. We don't discuss our struggles with other people. And then we become resigned to the idea that this experience has shown up to hang out and stay for good. Everything in life is temporary. Everything. It comes and it goes. So this is unmanageability. This is the real problem. And now Brandon's going to share his unmanageability exercise from one of his passes through the steps.
So this is actually the only one that I still have written out. But this was at about 3 years sober. Having trouble in personal relationships, an employer, a coworker. Stepson number one, stepson number two, mother of my children, sponsee number one, sponsee number two. Where am I having trouble controlling my emotional natures? 10-step buddy, the family dog, employer, mother of my children. Where am I experiencing misery and depression? At work. Where am I having trouble making a living? At work, paying bills on time, being efficient at work, paying down debt. Where do I have a feeling of uselessness? At work, with stepson number one, with my dying dog, with a sponsee. Where am I full of fear? The future, debt, making amends? Not a very hard exercise, guys. So this is 3 years sober. I don't have it all written out, so it'll take me a little bit to go through it. But so this was at closing in on 6 years of sobriety. Where am I having trouble controlling my emotional natures? With a committee member, with a guy that I'm taking through the steps, with my wife and her ex-husband, with people who are resistant to a different type of therapy, with another committee member. Another committee member. Sponsee, okay. Here's one at God, okay. Experiencing some, this one was probably full of fear, paying taxes. And then I got a bunch of fears here that are like paying taxes, paying medical bills, that I won't be able to pay the bills and will continue to suffer and cost money. There will never be discipline in others. I fear that I will slip away from people because I know that they have no way to transform their life. I will waste my entire day and not be able to manage the committee. He won't be able to get well and will eventually go out and get high. fear that she sets the wrong tone for the committee, fear that my perception of the world is not as attractive as I think it is. I think things need to be clear and or make sense for me to exist, not fully practicing all my disciplines, that didn't make any sense. But so guys, this is the unmanageability exercise. What's weird is that when I go through this, there are repeat offenders, okay? The mother of my children made my first three inventories. She's been doing pretty good not to piss me off in the last three, so she hadn't shown up. But stepkids have taken over. They've now broken the record. They're up to four inventories that they've made. My current wife's only made it to three. Family dog only made it to one. Sponsees show up at about every single one of them. So this is how the unmanageability exercise, the way that I can best define it is these are the areas where I'm playing God and I think I know what's best for the entire world and that God can't help me with this stuff. This is where I'm demonstrating current agnosticism in my life and that I think that I know what's right and that God can't be putting these experiences in my life for any purpose. And that's why this exercise is so incredibly powerful. If you're experiencing anything on any one of these levels, it's not only your current agnosticism, it's not only unmanageability. That's what untreated alcoholism and drug addiction looks like. Okay? These are the things, so clean or sober, that will take you back to drinking and using.
Or there can be an extreme amount of grace and mercy found in this if it drives you deeper into your relationship with God. Okay? It can go one of two ways, the way Brandon just described it, or you look at it with the intent that this is stripping me of things. Like somehow we are attached to things that we have to have in life in order to exist and have an identity. And most of the time I'm suffering unmanageability around these things being taken from me and I'm losing my identity. Well, I subscribe to the notion that I don't want an identity. I think that'd be a beautiful existence. But I'm human, so I struggle with that. But when I start to struggle with this stuff here, my intent is taking me deeper into my relationship with God. It's never, no longer is it a red flag for me to start doing a lot of stuff because I stay accountable with this guy. I stay accountable with like five or six other guys. They know this stuff is happening in my life. I'm not trying to hide it from anybody. It's there. It's coming for every single person in this room. Trials and low spots are promised. This is what they look like. Well, the way Brandon described them, I'm up against it. I'm up against the limitations of what I can do on my own. That's why I have to seek God. And that's what's going to dovetail us into the second step here, because once you see the powerlessness and you see the spiritual malady, because the spiritual malady is I'm not conscious of the presence of God in my life. All I'm conscious of is the thinking mind. Over and over and over. And that's what creates all the resistance in my life. Complete identification with a false... is that like an oxymoron? False reality? But that's what I'm going to call it. And so once I see powerlessness and unmanageability, I see a true picture of what my life is in the first step. So... once you work the steps, guys, the addict that lives inside of you cannot use the mental obsession most likely to get back in your life. He's going to use other stuff to get back in your life. He's going to try to reassert himself on the scene, or she's going to try to reassert herself on the scene through problems in personal relationships, fear, unhappiness. And the idea that I can't make a living, I hate my job, I can't be of real help to other people. That's how the addict starts to show up. And that's the breeding ground to bring back the idea that, you know, I'd rather be high than feel the way I'm feeling right now. It's not just not worth it. That's the delusion. And so we dovetail into step two, which, do you want to do this? 47 and 53.
Page 47. Top of the page. When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let your preconceived ideas and opinions you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. Great 10-step practice, wonderful place to do it here. Get a dictionary, look words up. See what they mean. What does creative intelligence mean? What does spirit of the universe mean? What is the realm of spirit? What is a supreme being anyhow? Look all these words up. What do they mean? Ask yourself what they mean. What does your God look like? At the start, this is all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to effect the first conscious relation with God, as we understood God. Afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth, but if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere, so we used our own conception, however limited it was. I have taken a guy into the third step with the understanding that he could accept that I believed in something. That's all I needed. If you believe that something is working in my life that I believe in, yes, okay. I just need that little crack. But if the person is absolutely, no, there is no God, there's no way that this can happen, there's no, not, well, okay. Maybe you need to get banged up some more. Because if you think the group's going to be your higher power, at some point in time, somebody in the group's going to piss you off, you're going to walk away, and then you lost your higher power. You've got to have a relationship with something else. So then they got this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful question that I like to tweak just a little bit. So we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe? Or am I even willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself that loves me and wants to have a relationship with me more than I could possibly ever imagine, that can take me beyond where I am right now in all of my personal relationships, at work, in everything I do? Is there room for improvement anywhere in my life? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. Cool. Let's go. That's it. Do you think that there's something that could help you with this? Okay. Page 52, at the bottom of the page, it talks about the Wright brothers' almost childish faith that they could build a machine which would fly was the mainspring of their accomplishment. Without that, sometimes go connect the book sentences to other sentences. Without what? Without their childish faith, nothing could have happened. So I've got to have this faith in this thing that people often think makes me silly to a level that makes me sometimes look silly in order for something to happen. And for you guys that are real busy, like being all tough and strong and like manly and I don't need anything, well, you do that until it doesn't work anymore, and then we've got this other thing where we can depend on this other stuff, this other power, to take us beyond where we are. So these pages, I love, these pages are great pages, but I didn't understand them when I was new in sobriety. Like, some of Bill's writing through We Agnostics is the most magical writing in the book after you have the perspective to understand what he's trying to sell you. But the first several passes through the book, it was just like, why is this guy going on and on and on about this stuff? But like what he sets for it before you, logic is great stuff. We liked it. We still like it. It is not by chance that we are given the power to reason, to examine the evidence or our senses, to draw conclusions. Everybody agree that you can do that stuff? Okay. Good. That is one of man's magnificent attributes. However, we agnostically inclined would not feel satisfied with a proposal which does not lend itself to a reasonable approach and interpretation. Hence, we are at pains to tell you why we think our present faith is reasonable, why we think it more sane and logical to believe than to not believe, why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy when we threw up our hands in doubt and said, I don't know. Good. At least if you don't know, you haven't taken a firm position that there is no God. Because if you're an alcoholic or addict and you've been crushed by a self-imposed crisis, if we've done anything to this point to prove to you that you're fucked, so you cannot postpone or evade, you have to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. What's your choice to be? Have you ever been wrong about anything before? Is it possible that there's a God? If somebody says it is not possible that there's a God, then I can't help them, because if you are that certain that there is no God, you will not be open to any other suggestion that I ever make of you.
Yeah.
Is it like at all possible? Well, good. Then we can go from there.
Where are we? 53. 55. Skip 54.
So, middle of page 55.
I know we've this chapter may seem like a blur because we're going through it so fast, but you got to remember there's a build up here. So first they talk to you about the electrons and protons that make up this table. They move really close together, and we can't see that, right? But we accept that. We can't see it, but we accept it. We know when this church pays its electric bill and you walk over and turn on the light switch that electricity is going to travel and turn the lights on. We cannot see it. But there's no perverse streak inside of us that tries to disprove it. The minute we start having discussions about God, there's a perverse streak that comes up out of us, and we laboriously set out to prove that it's not true. So the first thing the book's trying to do is say, look, you can definitely have the capacity to look at things this way. So let's transition. Is it possible? And then it starts talking about we have had faith in things. It's part of our makeup. We have all had faith in our thinking, guys. We have had complete faith and trust in our thinking. As faulty as it is, we operate in a world that says my thinking is right. That's faith. And then you think about those first 6 months in a relationship, that intoxicating lust, whatever it is, in the first 6 months, you have complete worship of that. So not only do we have the capacity to have faith, we have the capacity to worship things. It's all there. It's part of our makeup. That's what the book's trying to show you. The Wright brothers' childish faith is what propelled them into a willingness to make a decision, take some action, and get some results. That's what this process here is asking you to do. Because if you make a decision, take the action, get the results, somewhere along the way, the faith starts to transition into trust. And then you wake up one day and you actually trust this process and you trust your God. There's a line in the book that says, men of faith have courage, they trust their God. How do we get there? That's what that chapter is about. You've got the capacity. You have the makeup. It's already there. You were created with it. So I invite you to think about that.
So who in here has a stomach and in large intestines and small intestines and all that stuff? How do you know? You ever cut yourself open and seen it in there? Wait. Certain kind of faith. I mean, they told you you got it. You probably did those experiments in science class where you cut some other stuff open and figured it out. We'll see how weird this gets. It's going to be a little bit weird, but that's okay. So this morning, I came to the conclusion that I have eaten something green over the last several days. Okay? I mean, like, it's clear. There's something weird going on, right? Because it's green, right? Now, I can't blame that on anybody else. I had to have taken some sort of action for that to happen, right? Because, I mean, clearly that's not somebody else's stuff, right? I mean, that's... It was empty when I started, and now it's not, right? But that does not look like anything that I have put in my mouth. Something's happened. Okay? Now, I don't need to know exactly how that process worked. I've learned about it in school, but it doesn't fucking matter. I put it in, it comes out that way, and something happened. Right? But people really want to sit there and debate whether or not God exists because I can't see it. I can't touch it, and I don't want to touch that anyways. But there are results that cannot be explained in any other way in this existence. Well, that's a really strange comparison, but that's kind of what we're doing here, guys, is that it's... So something has to be doing something in order for something to happen. What is it? I don't know. How does it work? I don't know. Do I experience it? You bet. Okay? So on page 55, it says, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Somebody put a gun to your head and said, tell me what God is, something will come out of your mouth. It may be obscured by calamity, all this stuff going on around you, by pomp, all those things that we think we're excited about, by worship of other things like money and women and whatever else. But in some form or other, it is there. What is there? That fundamental idea of God. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. Think about all the gods that the Greeks and the Romans had, right? The Greeks had all these gods, the Romans had all these gods. And then there was the Jewish faith, and then there was Christianity, and somewhere during all that time there was Taoism and Buddhism, and then there along comes, you know, the Muslim faith. So we may argue about what God is, but it kind of seems like throughout everything, there's been some sort of something, right? Can we accept that that's there? We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was part of our makeup. It's existed forever, just as much as a feeling that we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but God was there. God was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that God may be found. It was so with us.
A few times in the book, they're going to reference this attitude. And this, if you can take this attitude into your spiritual path, I think you'll stay on the path. So what Brandon and I have done this weekend is to share our testimony in order to help maybe bring you to this attitude. Sweep away prejudice. That's why we use the set-aside prayer. Think honestly, self-examination, and search diligently within yourself. You can join Brandon and I on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. I think that's a real good summary of what I think we are compelled to have in a spiritual path is open-mindedness, a desire to reflect on how we are experiencing life and relationships, and then discuss it with other people. I think that's what we do here. I want to read a couple of things real quick. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's an amazing book called The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. I don't call it finding God, because how can you find that which was never lost? The very life that you are. The word God is limiting, not only because of thousands of years of misperception and misuse, but also because it implies an entity other than you. God is being itself, not a being. There can be no subject-object relationship here, no duality, no you, and then God. God realization is the most natural thing there is. The amazing and incomprehensible fact is not that you can become conscious of God, but that you are not conscious of God. The way of the cross that you mentioned is the old way to enlightenment, and until recently it was the only way. But don't dismiss it or underestimate its efficacy. It still works. There's a basket of fresh bread on your head, yet you go door to door asking for crusts. Knock on the inner door within, no other. Sloshing knee-deep in clear stream water, you keep wanting a drink from other people's water bags. Water is everywhere around you, but you see only barriers that keep you from water. A horse is moving beneath the rider's thighs, yet still he asks, "Where's my horse?" Right there under you. Yes, this is a horse, but where's the horse? Can't you see? Yes, I can see, but whoever saw such a horse? Mad with thirst, he cannot drink from the stream running so close by his face. He's like a pearl on the deep bottom, wondering inside the shell, where is the ocean? His mental questionings form the barrier. His physical eyesight bandages his knowing. Self-consciousness plugs his ears. Stay bewildered in God, and only that. The great reality, the last place we will look is deep down within. That's why the book says it's only in the last analysis that we find God. The Hindus have a wonderful story about Mara. Is that what they call it? Is it Mara? Oh, yeah. And Mara is another word for existence. And in their creation story, Mara decided to play a little game with itself. And it became an infinite number of pieces. And it gave each piece amnesia and played a game to see if each piece would claim its heritage. So it hid itself inside of each infinite piece of itself to see who would come back and find their divinity. And when the big book says the great reality is deep down within, I always remember that story because it's the last place that we look. But the big book clearly says we tap an unsuspecting inner resource. So you have to begin to ask yourself, is this true?
What about that? Go ahead.
I didn't comprehend that, but it sounded good.
Okay. Do you guys want me to share this? Is it the story you didn't comprehend?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Hindu's version of God was bored with itself and decided to play a game with itself. So it blew itself up into an infinite number of pieces, but it hid a sign of itself in every piece. But then it gave every piece amnesia, and it wanted to see who was going to come back home and claim its heritage. Who was going to go within to look instead of look without? We live in a culture, especially in the West, where everything's external. Our sense of who we are comes externally. If I want to feel good on the outside, it's going to take something good on. If I want to feel good on the inside, it'll take something on the outside to make it happen. So we're asking you to flip that script here, to dig deep down inside to find your great reality, not outside of yourself.
Gotcha. What about those that use the acronym GOD as good orderly direction?
I have no experience with that, brother.
If that works for them, it works for them.
Yeah. I just got to be truthful, man. I didn't grow up in that type of AA.
I mean,
don't lie to me.
Wow. Do I really want to put that kind of limitation on the thing that invented everything? I mean, like, so I would say we're pretty technologically advanced nowadays, right? We got like all this sort of stuff that thinks for us and everything. But you know, with all of our technology and all of our knowledge and all that we've figured out of the world to this point, you know that we have not been able to create as much as a fly out of nothing? I mean, we can't do that. But yet, something hasn't just created a fly. It's created this entire experience, right? So that puts a lot of limitation on humans, right? And good orderly direction sounds like a human kind of thing. And it's funny because, like, I mean, where do you stop reading? I mean, there's so many things. I mean, this is from a guy named Ralph Waldo Emerson that I read in high school and had no idea what he said. I read it after studying the spiritual path, and I read things like this: that which I call heaven and inwardly aspire after is the state or circumstances desirable to my constitution. So heaven's within me, right? That's kind of weird. That's what that book said. This book said it. Each man has his own vocation. The talent is the call. There is one direction in which all space is open to him. He has faculty silently inviting him thither to endless exertion. He's like a ship in a river. He runs against obstructions on every side but one. On that side, all obstruction is taken away, and he sweeps serenely over a deepening channel into an infinite sea. The talent is this talent and this call depend on his organization or his mode in which the general soul incarnates itself in him. He is inclined to do something which is easy to him and good when it is done, but which no other man can do. He has no rival. For the more truly he consults his inner powers, the more difference his work will exhibit from the work of any other. His ambition is exactly proportional to his powers. The height of the pinnacle is determined by the breadth of the base. Every man has this call of power to do something unique, and no man has any other call. The pretense that he has another call, a summons by name and personal election and outward sign that mark him extraordinary and not in the role of common men, is fanaticism and betrays obtuseness to perceive that there is one mind in all the individuals and no respect of persons therein. I don't really understand what the last couple sentences meant, but the gist of what I get out of that is that we're all connected and it's all inside all of us.
What book is that from?
It's out of Ralph Waldo Emerson's Spiritual Laws. But guys, this that was like early 1900s. I got another book that was from late 1800s, early 1900s. Like, guys, we think that this God shit's new. We think that this God being down deep down within us is new. Go grab an old book. It all says the same stuff. Read the Bible. It tells you that you're God too. Weird. What's that, huh? Explore. It's fun.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to break from now until 6 o'clock. Pizza should be here any minute.